Hi, I'm Ryan Meeks, and after years of trying to make life work as a struggling artist, independent filmmaker, and musician, I thought to myself, hey self, wouldn't it be helpful to ask other artists how they're finding their path in this world? And so now, that's exactly what I'm doing on a bi-weekly basis. Welcome to The Path of Art. Okay, today on The Path of Art, we have Kurt Bester. He's a composer based in Utah who has more than 40 film scores and more than 40 themes for national TV programs and commercials under his belt. He's also been given the Outstanding Film Score Award at the New York Film and Television Festival for his music for PBS, More Perfect Union. And he's gotten Emmys and done stuff with Jenny Oakes Baker. And you may also know him for a number that's pretty well known, The Prayer of the Children. Welcome to the podcast, Kurt.
It's great to be here. Thank you for that introduction. It's always kind of fun to hear introduction because I don't think about the stuff that I've... All the years I've been doing this, I don't quite keep track of what I've been doing. It's like, wow, I totally forgot about that that New York Film Festival award. Mm. And yet it was kind of exciting when it happened. But thank you. No, nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. And so let's jump into it. We like to get started with kind of, you know, who you are now, what are you doing now? And then later we dive into how did you get there, right? Yeah. And so I wanted to ask you, what compositions or arrangements that you've done do you feel you're most known for?
Well, you kind of brought it up in the introduction. The song Prayer of the Children, an original composition for voice only, has despite me, kind of become a thing. I'm not known as a vocalist. I'm known more as a composer and an arranger. But that particular song I sang with a vocal machine. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird how it came about. So if your listeners haven't heard this particular composition, it's about children and children of war. So I was... this was way back, about 25 years ago or so. I was watching on TV the war in Yugoslavia, and I had lived there. I'd lived in Yugoslavia and Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia, and now the war was – they were fighting each other. And it was really hard for me to handle that. I didn't know. I don't want to choose a side. Who do I want to win? Because I loved all these people. And so I kind of thought, well, children, they're kind of the victims. They didn't ask for war, but we mm-hmm. and yet they typically get hurt, either lose a parent or even lose their life or limbs or whatever. So I started writing a song. And I had this piece of gear, this keyboard that makes my turns my voice into parts. It's called a vocoder or vocalist. And you sing into it and then you play notes on a keyboard. And whatever notes you play on the keyboard splits your voice into parts. So you kind of sound like an instant choir. Right. And I was just kind of messing around with it. And I had this little melody line that I came up with, da-da-da, kind of a little Celtic-y thing. Mm-hmm. And then as I was listening on my ear here, I was listening to the news. I was thinking about the kids in Yugoslavia. So I kind of, can you hear? And then can you feel? I started dealing with the lyrics that way. And pretty soon I had this song written that was kind of haunting, and mm-hmm. to me anyway. I put it away, didn't do anything with it for 2 years, and ended up pulling it out at a concert, a private concert I was doing, where I had all these other kind of songs. And then I just thought, I'm going to sing this song. And so I did. And it had a pretty shocking reaction. The audience was kind of like hush. They didn't know how to deal with it because it was a pretty haunting kind of song. Mm-hmm. I sang it with my machine, which is kind of weird, made it just sound like a Gregorian chant. And anyway, from that moment until now, the song has become its own thing. It gets sung by, oh man, tons of people. Recently sung at the 9/11 commemoration by the Harlem Boys Choir. It gets sung every year at the Columbine commemoration. Mm-hmm. It gets sung by a group called Three Dog Night, which some of your older listeners might be familiar with. They're a rock group. They play rock and roll, but then they put their guitars down and they sing a version of the song. So to answer your question, because of the notoriety, because of the effect that song has and the meaning that it still portrays, even mm-hmm. though the war in Yugoslavia is over, now people sing it for the war in Ukraine, or they sing it mm-hmm. for kids who are dealing with suicide. The lyrics kind of work for that. So there you go.
And I remember, at least like when I was a teenager, I would hear it a lot during Christmas, like around Christmas time. Was that because I know that you arrange a lot of Christmas arrangements? Is that because of that? Or do you think it was just kind of more people trying to focus on people that really need help during Christmas?
I can't really say what people's motivation is to listen to it at that time. It isn't a Christmas song, but it does have the word Jesus in it. But I think, you know, I think it's one of those things where at Christmas time, people want to feel peace. They want to feel those nice, warm Christmas feelings. And so maybe that's why. It's a bit like the Messiah. People, it's not a Christmas production, the oratorio, but people at Christmas time listen to it, and then it feels like a Christmas song. So I don't think it's incongruous to listen to Prayer of the Children during Christmas, but you know, whenever people want to listen, I'll be glad.
As long as they're listening, right?
That's right.
So what compositions or arrangements do you feel most proud of, or that you just have more of an affinity toward those compositions or arrangements?
You know, it's a difficult question to sum it down to just a few. So I'll just throw out some, but I mean, I'll throw out a couple, but they're not necessary. Then I'm going to go, oh, wait, I forgot about that. Because I write so much. I mean, I'm writing constantly for different people and myself. I tend to like the ones that where I'm not having to write for somebody else, where I'm not a gun for hire. I did, for example, an original ballet. The music was original, based on The Secret Garden. And it's a full-length ballet. It's very hard for people to produce it because it takes a lot of money to produce a ballet. So it only gets performed rarely. But I've conducted it a few times with the ballet group, and I always think, you know what, that's me. That really feels like me. Historically, there was another time I had a chance to do music for the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. I was asked to compose a 10-minute piece of music, which is not easy to do, a march as the athletes came back into the stadium for the closing ceremonies. So, you know, you've seen the Olympics, you've seen that moment. So I wrote that music, and I wanted to portray as many cultures in the musical sound and in the palette that I chose, you know, from Asian to African to Western and everything I could think of. So as you listen to this song, and I was able to conduct it, that was kind of the part that makes it memorable. So it was freezing cold off. It was February 5th, I think. It was so cold that I felt really bad for the brass players because their mouthpiece would stick to their lips.
Right.
And they had to keep wetting their lips with warm water to make that not happen. It was so cold. But I didn't notice it when I started conducting the piece. I was conducting with my right hand. The orchestra is in front of me, and the musicians were in behind me. So I kept kind of turning around and looking at them. And then I also had a camera that I was holding. So I was conducting, and I was taking pictures, which is a little cheesy. But then I noticed that Moby, who was also performing, he was doing the same thing. So I guess if he can do it, I could do it. There but those were a couple of meaningful things. Because I've written music in so many different styles, sometimes it's easier to talk about styles. I'm currently writing an original piece of music based on a children's story that I've written, and it's called Harmon E. and the Missing Key. It's about a little boy who lives in a town that has no music, and he discovers this cave full of things. He doesn't know what they are. It turns out they're instruments, and so he has to go find the people that play these instruments so he can bring music back to the town. So it's a bit like Peter and the Wolf. Like it's a hopefully for all ages. And now I'm writing the music that goes along with the narration. So that's something that I'm not proud of it yet because I haven't finished it. But when I get done, I think that's something that's going to be meaningful.
And it seems like you're excited about what it's going to be.
Yeah, I know. I've been working on it for a while. And that's the problem with being a musician these days, is that your art also has to be the way you pay the bills. I mean, at least for me.
Right.
And so it's like, oh, I want to do that original song, but now I got to write some music for Jenny, or I've got to write some music for Andrea Bocelli, or who I happen to be working with at the time. It's like, oh, I'll never get to my piece.
Right.
Finding the perfect storm is when someone says, hey, can you write an original piece? And I say, yes. And then they bring up the money and I've got the time, and then I don't have to worry about paying the bills. It doesn't happen very often.
Right. I've actually talked about that before, where in the arts and you when you start doing like commissions and stuff, it just feels like you're not being an artist, right? You're just doing, you're being someone else's hand for their art, right?
It can lead to that. I have to say, though, if you're really conscientious, I try everything that I do, no matter whether it's an arrangement for a singer or a violinist or an orchestra or what it is, I always try to just be artistic. Mm-hmm. And the way that I view art anyway is a little different than some. People tend to kind of take all the aspects of art and put it in one box. Mm-hmm. I take the craft out, and I call the craft of what I do is knowing the orchestration, knowing the instrumentation. Mm-hmm. If you've got people out there who are cinematographers, their craft is knowing how to use their gear, knowing how to edit if they're an editor. The art... And there's art involved in all aspects of this.
Right.
But if you, for me, my art is kind of in my head and in my heart. And I have to make sure that my craft is high enough up that I've got the highest craft I can, that I'm a really good at piano. I'm really good at hearing things. I have a good knowledge of lots of different musical styles. So when I get this idea, my craft doesn't get in the way of my art. And I think a lot of people who are in music, they go, oh, I hear this song in my head, and but I can't get it down. I can't play it. I can't tell it. So I have to get somebody else to figure it out. And they get really frustrated, but that's because they haven't spent the time to get their craft honed. And I've been doing this for 4 decades, and I'm still honing my craft. I'm still listening to music every day. I listen to music for about an hour.
And sometimes that can influence the art as well. As you're learning your craft and you learn something more about how it works, it kind of brings ideas. Sometimes.
Most people are afraid of like copying somebody else. They're like, oh, I got to be original. And I think that's great. We should all be original. But we are all influenced by people. And when you're first starting out in your art, you listen to somebody or, you know, in the case of a cinematographer or photographer, you look at other people's works and you say, ooh, I like that, how they did that pan, how they use that filter, how they. Mm-hmm. And then in my case, ooh, I love how that chord. I like how John Williams combined those woodwinds. And when I first started writing, I got really close to like lawsuits practically just because I was really influenced by other composers. And not on purpose, but just because I wasn't pretty young.
Well, and you need a foundation of something to start on, right? And what you listen to is that foundation.
Yeah. What happens, Ryan, what eventually happens, if you have some mentors and some people that you think you want to be like, and you write like them, or maybe even you write a piece of music down that sounds like them, eventually you're going to replace their influence will be there, but your style will emerge. And now people tell me, oh yeah, I was told by a client, write some music with that Kurt Besser sound. And so now, you know, I have a sound. And people know it
when
they hear it.
I think you do. Like, when I hear stuff and I'm like, I think this is Kurt Bester. There's something about it.
And I'm not embarrassed by that. I know some composers, a friend of mine, well, Sam Carden, a good friend of mine, he oftentimes says, oh, I don't want people to recognize me. I don't want to have a definitive style because I'll get pigeonholed. But you can't. You know, you can't do that. I mean, did Picasso get pigeonholed? Did John Williams get pigeonholed? Does Steven Spielberg get pigeonholed? I mean, when you get your style that recognizable, just treat it like a strength and know that you can't write everything and you can't do everything. You can't please everybody or you'll end up being milquetoast in all the different areas.
Right. And I would say even figuring out your style is what's going to help you get an audience.
Absolutely. And that happens. That doesn't happen intellectually. For me, figuring out your style just kind of happens. It's like you just write, and next thing you know, you have a tendency to write with certain instrumentations and sounds and approaches. My trick now is to still have some freshness so that I don't just copy myself, because I could do that. Mm-hmm. But that's not satisfying to me. That doesn't make my career last longer because people go, yeah, Bester was great, but it's getting kind of tired now. And I don't want that.
Right. So how do you go about, like, what is your process for arranging and composing music?
Well, the process for arranging and composing kind of depends on the project. If I'm arranging a song, Obviously, and what that means for people who aren't familiar with the term arranging. Arranging is kind of like composition with a head start. You're taking a song and you're redoing it. It's like a cover in the pop world. I'm doing a cover. I just happen to do it more in a crossover classical world. So what that means is I listen to the melody, I listen to the harmony, the way it is done, and then I kind of just go, I wonder what this would sound minor instead of major. What if I, instead of using a piano, what if I did classical guitar? What if I, you know, so then I try all kinds of real clever little things to kind of twist your brain as you listen. And I've kind of made a living at this in my Christmas world, but I do all these Christmas concerts where I've taken Christmas songs like Silent Night. I've probably arranged that song 6 or 7 times, different ways. So anyway, the process in arranging is that I listen to my client, because normally I'm arranging for somebody. What do you want? What are you looking for? Oh, well, I'm looking for something that's kind of like this big. I want to sound like Hans Zimmer, or I want to, and then I kind of go that direction. If I'm composing something, oftentimes it's for a movie, or it's for a dance or a ballet. It's for something existing. I'll watch the movie tons of times, and oftentimes the guys that are doing movies they use a temp track. So they lay down music from something else. Of course, they can't use it in the final thing. So they kind of say to me, maybe you could sound somewhat similar to this. It's not my favorite thing, because I'd rather just watch a movie and just be inspired to write whatever. But these days you kind of have to do that. So it kind of depends. My process is to sit down at a computer with about 3 screens. On one screen, I have all the instruments you could ever imagine in kind of what we call a digital audio workstation, or a DAW. And that allows me to kind of listen to different things and mock things up. I'm using a keyboard, a piano keyboard, as well as a computer keyboard. And I'd go, let's see, I'm writing for a harp, so let me bring up a harp. And so I'm playing like a piano, but it sounds like a harp, or it sounds like strings. I used to, when I first started, I just kind of did it in my head, because we didn't have the computer world like we do now for music. And then I just take a pencil and write on paper. But since we have all these new tools, I use them. And then I've got on another screen, I have an engraving program. Your musicians who might be listening, Finale is what I use, and I use those together. So as I'm working with my digital audio workstation over here, I'm also putting the music down over here with my fancy computer pencil, and then it just goes. So I'm sure I can get into the weeds on this, but we're talking about art in general, not necessarily just composing.
So do you spend a certain time of year that you're composing and then move on to recording, or does it mix together, or how does that work out?
I'm composing and arranging and recording and performing all year round, 365. I mean, it's people, because I do these Christmas shows, people kind of think, oh, well, because they only see me maybe during that time. Yeah, you do those Christmas shows and then you must just like go to Cancun the rest of the year and just, and now that's totally not true. I actually have to work really, really hard. And that's the hard part about the business of using your art. And that's why people try to talk you out of it. Your parents, oh, well, I'm sure you want to go into painting, but maybe you ought to have something to fall back on.
Fall back on.
Which I hate that term.
Oh my gosh, I've heard that so many times.
I know. But you know what? If you don't, and here's my little musical gospel message. If you really want to do something, you got to be passionate. And you could be a lawyer and be passionate. You could be a doctor, accountant, maybe. But, you know, in terms of if you're passionate about music or passionate about art, go with it. I mean, go with it. Otherwise, you're not going to compete. I mean, I have friends who one guy ended up being an orthopedic surgeon so that he could have something to fall back on. Well, now he doesn't have any time to do music. He's too tired. He hasn't been honing his craft. So, I mean, I'm not, you know, naive enough to think that everybody can do it. It's hard. And I get jealous of my friends who have pension plans and health care and all that, since I have those things, but I have to, you know, I have to do it myself, and it's more expensive and it's hard. And I'm working 6-7 days a week, sometimes long hours, whereas my friends are retiring. And I don't think I'll ever retire, because what do I retire to? I love what I do.
Yeah. Most people retire to do something that they actually wanted to do, right? And you're doing what
I'm doing what I love. And so I guess the end of that comment is basically be passionate about what you're doing, and don't be afraid. Take a chance. Fear will breed creativity. And many times, and I just kind of raised a question, perhaps. It's like, how does fear aid creativity? What I recommend to anybody is accept a gig, whether it's painting or whatever your creative thing is, whatever your art is. Somebody says, hey, can you paint a commission? And you, in your mind, you go, no, I'm not ready. I'm not ready to it. So don't say yes. But be brave and say, yeah, sure, I can do that. Hey, do you want to do a movie? I got some money. And you're thinking, oh, I'm not ready yet. I don't know how to do that. But if you're afraid, but you say yes, you'll have your fetal position moments, but then you're going to step up and you're going to learn how to do it. You're right. Going to say, wow, I've never been in front of Final Cut Pro or whatever. So I got to learn it. And that fear to get something done will make you do it. And then you're like, man, then you get confidence. And I still get afraid of stuff. There's still stuff that people ask me. It's like, oh my gosh. When Andrea Bocelli asked me to do an arrangement for him, I mean, I knew I could do it, but it's like, he's kind of a big deal. And I thought, I got to really impress the socks off of him. And I was afraid, but I was confident enough to know that so I worked really hard and it paid off, you know, and he was really happy. And so there you go.
Well, that's amazing. Some great advice from Kurt Bester here. We're going to take a short break. And when we get back, we're just going to go into how he got to where he is and what it takes to get there. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Path of Art. We're here with Kurt Bester, and we just had a wonderful first half with just all the advice that you've given is just so good. I think it's going to be so helpful for everybody. Well, I want to ask where you got started, like interested in music. I know that you came from Wisconsin, you grew up there, and you played the bugle at some point.
Well,
is that what it's called? Is the bugle?
Well, I play the flugel.
Flugel. Oh.
I can play a bugle.
Wait, bugles are snacks, right?
Yeah. Well, bugles are what wake you up when you're in the army.
Oh, gotcha.
Flugelhorn is a cousin of the trumpet. But that actually gets to how I started. My grandpa played trumpet with Tommy Dorsey. Tommy Dorsey was a big band leader in the 40s and 50s. Well, 30s, 40s, 50s. My grandpa played trumpet with him. And so Jeanette, and then he taught my dad to play trumpet. My dad taught me. On that side of the family, the Bester side, there's just a lot of genetic musical material. Mm-hmm. My I don't know what he is to me. My second uncle, I think, something like that. Don Bester. He wrote the J-E-L-L-O spot that some of your listeners might remember. J-E-L-L-O.
Oh.
An old Jell-O commercial that was huge for years. And then he also wrote Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf? Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf? And he was big band leader for Jack Benny. He was Jack Benny's orchestra leader. So on that side of the family, I have a lot of genetic musical material. Mm-hmm. On the other side of the family, they're not slouches either. They come from Switzerland, my mom's side of the family. My grandpa and grandma had a yodeling club in Wisconsin. So I don't yodel. Don't even ask me. But at least I know that I like cheese and yodeling from that side.
Mm-hmm. Well, and cheese in Wisconsin is just
amazing. Yeah, it's pretty much like eating funeral potatoes here.
Right.
we're in Utah. That's Google it. Anyway, but how I got started was it's kind of naturally. I mean, I just in my family. You were required to do four things. You had to go to school, go to church, be on the swimming team, because my dad was a swimming coach, and then you had to take piano lessons. And there was no questions asked. I mean, you could complain about it because nobody likes practicing piano.
Right.
But I would practice the piano, but I would also mess around on the piano. So when I was a little kid, I'd sit down and I'd just kind of mess around. I don't know what I was doing. I was just kind of like, I liked how sounds sounded, you know, played different chords. I just like how they sound. And then I would take my piano piece, like a Bach piece or something, and I would jig it up, you know, just kind of jazz it up. Mm-hmm. And my piano teacher, rather than getting mad at me, because I'd sometimes say, hey, listen to the, how I do this song. I do it different. She would say, Kurt, that's great. In the recital, I want you to play it two ways. Play it the way it's written and then play it your way. And she would let me do that. And thanks to her, that was kind of one thing. And my mom also noticed that I was messing around on the piano. And she said to me one day, and because I hated to practice. I just hated it. She said, Kurt, put your music away. I go, oh, yes, I get to quit. No, I don't want, you're not going to quit. What I want you to do is I want you to play me a sunrise. That's exactly what she said. And I didn't really know what she meant, you know. But she said, yeah, just kind of make up something and think of, make it kind of sound like a sunrise. So I did that. And it probably sounded terrible. I don't, you know, I'm not some little genius Mozart, I'm sure. But she just made me feel really great. It was like, oh, Kurt, I could see the sunrise. That was really wonderful. And I think at that moment, that was kind of the seminal moment for my career to start. And so it was thanks to a real intuitive piano teacher and a mother who was also a piano player, but was kind of a creative English teacher who would think of outside the box like that. Mm-hmm. She knew I wasn't going to be like Josh Wright here at the University of Utah, who's an amazing classical piano player. But she knew that I had this unique thing that she was hearing me do, just ad-libbing stuff. That was the very beginning. And of course, then, you know, one goes on and things happen along the way. I'll jump to the first gig I ever got. So I'd written songs in junior high, wrote a song for a girl in seventh grade, you know, just goofy stuff like that. But when I was in junior in high school, I was a trumpet player in the band, Orem High School, and I got a call from the music contractor for the Osmonds. He said, hey, you know, I hear you're pretty good for a high school kid. You play good. And I guess the word got out that I read well and I could play well for my age. He said, our trumpet player got sick. We have three trumpets. Only two showed up. Can you come down right now and play trumpet in our recording session? I said, well, I'm going to have to skip school. He said, well, whatever it takes, you know, get to. And so I went down. They paid me $40 an hour. It's not bad.
Wow. Yeah.
In those days, it was
still good nowadays,
even now.
Too,
right.
Yeah.
So I show up. I was afraid. Mm-hmm. Like, can I do it? But I stepped up. And I did it. And I guess I was in tune and I guess I sounded good because they called me a few more times. And then one day, music director of the show said, hey, Kurt, you know, I hear you can compose music. I said, yeah. And he said, how'd you like to compose a little something for the Donnie and Marie show that we were working on? I said, that's the Osmonds, by the way, Donnie and Marie Osmond. So I said, yeah, I can do that. I remember what I'm saying. I said earlier in the show before we took our break, fear breeds creativity.
Right.
So I said, sure, I can do that. Because it meant money, too. They're going to pay me some money. And they said, well, there's this guy. His name's Dick Van Dyke. He's going to come in the show, and he has this little – he needs a play on to play us out a commercial. So like a 30-second piece. And I stayed up all night long. I mean, I could do that now, like in 20 minutes. It would take – I could do that falling off a log today. Mm-hmm. But that was my first – professional gig. So I stayed up all night and I had to write for trumpets and saxophones and trombones, kind of a big band configuration, rhythm section. And I, you know, I didn't even know the transpositions. I didn't have a computer to do it. This was pencil and paper.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. I had to go, now what key, how does it? So I'm looking up. It's so funny to say, because I mean, I'm not like 90 years old, but I'm old enough to where I couldn't look up on the computer what a transposition for an alto sax was.
Right.
Today you'd look it up on the computer. So I had to call somebody on the phone and say, hey, I'm arranging for alto sax. Yeah, it's up a sixth, you know, and you have this different transposition. Anyway, I showed up the next day. I had copied out the music, handed it all out. They played it, it sounded great. And I was hooked. I thought, this is what I'm going to do. This is it. I want to write music like this. And, I could bore you for hours with all the stories that got me from there to where I am today. So I'll let you ask some questions.
No, this is great.
But anyway, it started with my mom, and then went to the Osmonds, and then it just kept going.
And so, I mean, was that the experience there? Was that the one that kind of made you think, hey, I can do this. This is what I'm going to do now.
Well, I knew that I could write music because, like I said, I had written music a few things. I knew I could write piano songs. I knew that I could write a little something, you know, for a few instruments because I had messed around with that in high school, my sophomore year, before I started working for the Osmonds. But it gave me two things. It said, you can do it. Somebody asks you, you can do it. Secondly, I made some money. And so it was kind of like, now it's not like, well, I'm going to go do a hobby. It's like I actually made more money than all my friends on their paper routes. And I could see that was something I could do. I couldn't live a life of writing music for like a television show. That would lose its luster after a while.
Right.
So really around the same time, I think maybe a senior. So I'd been writing music for the Osmonds and I thought, okay, I'm going to do this, but I wasn't really sure. I thought, well, I'm going to have to go to LA or whatever. Cause there weren't, you know, the Osmonds came to Utah. So thank goodness that gave me LA came to me.
Right.
But, I saw the movie Jaws. Jaws came out, mm-hmm. and I heard the John Williams score, which is more than two notes, but we know it as bum, bum,
right.
Bum, 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 bum. And I remember not only being scared by the movie, but saying to myself, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I want to write music for movies. I mean, it's fine to write a little thing for Dick Van Dyke. It's fine to do a little 30-second spot for a commercial. I want to write movie music, film music. Mm-hmm. And my eyes kind of opened to film music because I really hadn't thought about it that much before that. So now I had my art blossoming and I saw a trajectory. And the trajectory was write music for film. And that's where I aimed my eyes. And I remember doing a movie for a kid at BYU called The Magdeburg Affair. It was pretty heady stuff. We didn't have all the synthesizers you have now. So I couldn't right. mock it up like an orchestra now. I had to actually ask my friends in the orchestra, hey, would you come? I'm going to bring some cookies and drinks.
Wow.
Would you come and play the session? And we mm-hmm. hired the studio and we had an orchestral score because we couldn't do it with synthesizers, which is kind of cool. And so I was off and running, and I think that trajectory kept me going for quite a while. Not to where I am today, though. However, I'll be mysterious about that. So so you can ask a question.
Well, let's go into that. Let's go into what got you to where you are today. I mean, what is the experience that you feel pushed you to where you are today?
Well, I'll tell you, and this is a bit of a lesson as well, as it's my history, but it also is going to teach anybody who's following in my footsteps a lesson. Mm-hmm. And that is be willing to do things out of your determined box. Like I had determined that I was going to be a film composer. So if somebody asked me to write music for ballroom dancing or write music for the Utah Symphony or write or do something, I probably at that time I would have said, I'm sorry, but I only do film scores. I am a film composer. But luckily, and partially because I need to pay the bills, I started when people would say, hey, can you do this? And I said to my brain said, well, no, that's not a film composed, but you, man, they're going to pay you a couple $100. Why don't you just say yes and make some money? So I did that. And I started doing arrangements for people. Mm-hmm. And I found that I had an ability that was unique in that area that other people didn't have. Plus, there were a lot. This is the end of an era in a way where people like me knew how to write for orchestra, knew the transpositions, knew all that music theory stuff.
Right.
And we're getting into a time because of synthesizers and computers where a lot of young composers at the time, they didn't want to. I don't need to mess with learning about that. I can just play the synthesizer. I can play the strings right here. Look, it's strings. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people kind of didn't do what I did. So I was becoming valuable in that regard. And I found that being kind of a musical chameleon was a good thing. It wasn't a bad thing, especially at that stage of my career, mm-hmm. because who knows where I was going to be when I was in my 50s. But now I realize how valuable it was. I mentioned ballroom dance music, for example. I'm not really fond of dancing ballroom dance, but I love writing the challenge of writing music. So I have for 25, almost 30 years written music for world championship ballroom dance teams. And I have to, in order to do that, I have to know how to write a waltz, a tango. I have to know all these rhythms. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the standard medleys are usually orchestral pieces, so I have to know how to write for an orchestra. Then the Latin medleys, I have to know how to write for a rhythm section. And, you know, I have to know how to surdo or a timbale or all these different things. So I had to really fill my data bank with all kinds of material. And that flexibility is what I'm saying to anybody who wants to do what we do with their art. Don't say you don't do things. I mean, there are a few things I don't want to do, and maybe I won't. But for the most part, I like the challenge. And I like the challenge of writing something, trying something brand new, and which is probably why I can cover a wide range of musical styles.
And so on that note, what is the thing that, or is there one thing that you wish that you had known that before you started on this path?
I guess I'm kind of dumb enough to have not thought too deeply about that stuff. I mean, I just jumped in. A lot of people, when they start out in any kind of artistic endeavor, they want to plan it all out. They go, okay, I'm going to go to art school, and then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do, and then I'm going to get business cards, then I'm going to get a manager, then I'm going to get an agent, rather than just get in and just do it. It's a don't try to think through it so much. Don't plan everything. Mm. If you're a cinematographer, and good grief, you know, we have phones now. We can do a little movie with a phone, and just to practice things. You don't have to wait until, well, I'm going to wait till I get enough money, and then I'm going to buy a really nice camera, and then I'm going to get all these computer things and do that. It's like, just jump in. So like I said, I was kind of dumb enough that I didn't really plan things out, but I was a good opportunist. And I think there is luck in life. There's luck in artistic. How did you get the music for the Olympics? How did you get music for this? Everything kind of, I got lucky, little lucky things, but I took those opportunities.
Right. And you made connections along the way.
I made connections.
Right?
Yeah, that's a big thing, especially now these days. I mean, networking in the arts. At a certain point, you're going to find, anybody in the arts is going to find that if you're up for a gig, if you're up for a painting commission or a film project or a who knows what, you're going to be up against 10 other people, all who are equally talented. Mm. If at a certain point. So who do they want to work with? Here's something I wish I would have been told. What makes the difference is talent is a given. Mm-hmm. Who's on time? Who's pleasant to work with?
Right.
You know, I mean, there are people out there, I won't name names, but there are people that I work with who are talented, but they are so obnoxious to work with that I just don't want to do it. It's not fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, can you do it on budget? You know, so are just all those little personal things that have nothing to do with your art. An artist tend to be a little egotistical. It's like, oh, I can't believe you want me to change that note. That note came down from heaven. And, you know, it's like, you know, I just, at a certain point, you know, you just say, you know what? I can, lots of ways to skin a cat. I'll do it your way. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Now, if I feel really strongly about something, I won't acquiesce, but I do think it's the people skills. It's the communication is another thing. Mm-hmm. It's when you're talking art. This is a funny thing. So I'll never forget. I did a movie score, and the director, Kurt, I just want to tell you one thing. You know, I really like your music, but I'm going to tell you right now, I don't like clarinets. I just don't like that sound. I don't want to hear any clarinets in my music. So, which is a weird thing to hear somebody say. So, fair enough. You know, I wasn't going to do a polka or something. I wasn't going to take a clarinet and do some cheesy sound, but I like the color in an orchestra of a clarinet. It's very, you won't hear it, but so anyway.
But it does add something.
It does add something. And he was just trying to be. Film music is weird because the directors, they usually know what they're doing when it comes to lighting and dialogue, and they know, but when it gets to the music, they don't know. They're like, they hand you their little baby they've been working on for maybe years, and they get done filming, and then they hand it to you, the composer, and they go, take this up to the mountain and come back with great music for my baby. Right. And they're afraid. They're scared. So they always want to jump in and say things. Anyway, this guy said that. And then he really liked this John Williams piece, and he had used it as a temp track. So he said, why don't you use this John Williams piece as a reference? And I'm thinking to myself, it's got clarinet all over it. So I didn't write for clarinet. Because he asked me not to, but I couldn't get the sound he wanted without putting clarinet in.
Right.
Anyway, I jumped all around, and so my lesson here is communicating in art is difficult. It's very difficult. How do you explain something to a person?
How do you quantify feelings and emotions to people? Right.
Yeah. How do you tell people what you want in an art that they don't understand?
Right.
And so I always tell my clients and people, use language like you want something kind of fuzzy. You want, you know, don't try to talk to me in music. You don't know music, but you know feeling. So how do you want that people to feel when they hear the music? How do you want, and they might use words that they're kind of with, well, I want time to stop. I want to feel like I can't breathe. I want all those things. If you tell those to me, I can translate that into music. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I say when you're working with clients, don't worry. You don't have to talk cinematography. You don't have to talk. Just tell me how you want to feel. Cause everybody knows how to feel. Right. We all feel. And art is about feeling, at least the kind of art that I do. Wow, we got going on a tangent there, but that was kind of fun.
Hey, it was a great tangent. I love it. I think it was super amazing and helpful. Well, I mean, what advice would you give to someone that's, you know, just starting out and they want to be a composer or arrange music? What advice would you give to them?
Well, I would say this. I would say there really are no shortcuts. If you're 21 years old and you've got good music talent, you were the best kid in your high school, but now you're competing in a world where with a bunch of other people who are the best kids in their high school, you got to get that craft part. You have to dive in and get that craft. If you're a singer, for example, don't think that, well, if I could get a record contract, if I could meet a famous producer, Rick Rubens or somebody like that, you got to get your craft. So take your guitar, sit down in a coffee shop, offer to play for, you know, hot chocolate and donuts, and just play. That get that muscle, get that musical muscle going, and you will be ready when the record company eventually comes. But you can't, a lot of people think, well, I got to get my business card and I got to get my name for my company. Whatever. Just get out there and do what you're going to do. And then look for those opportunities. Because if you're good enough, suddenly the opportunities they'll come.
So what's next for you? I know you have a Christmas concert coming up.
I do, yes. We're taping this in close to the month of December. I know it's a podcast, so people can listen, who knows, for as long as they want. But I do. This is my 35th year of doing Christmas concerts. Those arrangements we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing a bunch of arranging right now. Just did arranged Bach's Ave Maria yesterday. And today I got to work on another piece to get ready for my Christmas show. And it's weird. Right now, after January, I've got I'm going to do an album for a client in January and February. And then I guess I don't have any work.
And then you got to find it, right?
Then you got to find it and it will come. There's a lot of people knocking on my door, but that's the scary part. And it's not very comfortable. You know, when you work for yourself, my wife kind of wishes that I had a 9-to-5 once in a while, but it's you know, the reward is worth it. The reward to be passionate about your art, to have spent the time, years and years and years, honing your craft so that you can create what's in your heart to create. There's really nothing for me better.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I think that's some great advice. This has been another episode of The Path of Art with Kurt Bester. This was just such a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Good luck to everybody who wants to follow their passion. I'll be watching and cheering from the sidelines.
All right, and we'll catch y'all next time. Thank you for listening to The Path of Art. If you or someone you know is creative and would like to tell your story, reach out to me at rmeeks@ksl.com. I might feature you on the show. If you liked our conversation, please make sure you follow the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. It really does help people to discover the show. Also, make sure you follow The Path of Art podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.